If you could do one thing for brain health, it would be sleep. And sleep consistently and sleep deeply.
Welcome to Teach Me Something New. I'm your host, Britt Morin, and this is a production of iHeartRadio and Brit & Co. All my life, everyone's told me I should focus on being good at one thing. But the truth is, I'm curious about a lot of things. But how do you learn about everything? The answer? Make the world's best experts teach you in less than an hour. So come along with me as we all learn something new.
Dr. Crystal Dilworth, also known as Dr. Brain on the popular CBS show Mission Unstoppable, is a neuroscientist, addiction expert, and a vocal advocate for women in STEM. She's here today to teach us about the chemical messengers in the brain that influence our mood and the science behind habit building. Buckle up for a fun and stimulating conversation that is sure to leave you feeling smarter and more in tune with what's happening inside your head. Welcome, Crystal.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I'm always fascinated to talk to neuroscientists, but before you were a neuroscientist, you were a professionally trained modern dancer. Is this correct?
Yes, absolutely. I was. I sort of grew up feeling pulled in two opposite directions because I was a victim of the stereotype that you have to be a science person or not a science person and you can't be both. And so I really struggled with that for most of my life because I loved dancing, but I also loved science. And it actually, after undergrad, I got my degree in biochemistry from UCSD, and then I moved to New York to be a professional dancer, and I was going to leave science behind. But I couldn't quite do that, and I was actually on the train uptown to Columbia to watch a chemistry department seminar, skipping dance class, when I realized, maybe I need to pay attention to this sort of like shift in priorities. Like the data is telling me something. And that's actually the moment that I decided to go to graduate school.
Oh, wow. I mean, I think that's a big struggle that we all have to fight at some point. I was a dancer and a soccer player, not a scientist, growing up though, not like when I was 20. And I remember having to choose and it felt so hard. So I can't imagine science and dance, two totally distinct opportunities for you. And so now you're one of, you know, pretty few women in neuroscience. Do you ever feel lonely or does it actually feel empowering that you get to represent, you know, half the population in a field that doesn't have half the population?
I mean, I think that science and medicine, you know, we are starting to realize the massive holes and gaps in our understanding that have arisen because we haven't paid attention to specific populations, be that women or, you know, other genetic backgrounds, other, you know, racial backgrounds. And so it really takes all kinds to be able to contribute to the universal pool of knowledge. I mean, I certainly have had and continue to have the experience of being the only woman in the room, as I'm sure you yourself have experienced multiple times.
Yeah, it's not that different in Silicon Valley.
Oh, no, not at all. But I think that neuroscience, although it is a highly technical field, with its accessibility through biology and human behavior, is actually more accepting maybe of women in the field than say quantum physics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quantum physics is a whole different conversation we can come back to have at a different time on this podcast. So let's get into addiction. I know a lot of your research has been rooted in this field. Mm-hmm. So I think when I say addiction, I think people's brains go straight to, oh, nicotine and alcohol. And obviously those are addictive things. We've learned about that in life, but there are a lot of other addictions too. So we'll get to the other addictions, but I guess we'll just start with the easy ones. Nicotine. What's happening to our brain when we become addicted to something? And is it different based on the type of drug, quote unquote, nicotine, alcohol, sex, et cetera?
So there's obviously similarities, and then based on what you are addicted to, the mechanism is going to be different. Like how you get there, it will be different. But what there looks like, which is overactivation of what neuroscientists would call the dopamine reward system, which is that positive feedback loop that kind of hijacks dopamine's role in the brain. And there's clinical components to that, but as a neuroscientist, I'm really looking at two of the like biological components. One would be the behavioral impact due to learning and memory. So we learn that this is preferable, this drug is preferable, for instance, to other things, and we remember how we feel when we're on it and who we were with and where we were, and all of that matters. And then there's the actual chemical response in the brain. And that was sort of my PhD thesis, was looking at specific protein level changes that happen in your brain when you're exposed to nicotine. So you smoke one cigarette and your body goes, interesting, I might get that again. And it actually changes the proteins that certain neurons in your brain make to be able to respond better and differently the next time. And it takes a while once you are accustomed, you know, once you're a smoker, it takes a while, maybe never, but it certainly takes a long time for your brain to go back to that original protein composition.
Yeah. And so like for smoking, let's just stick on that for a second. Hmm. How many times do I need to smoke a cigarette to become addicted?
That depends on your genetic background. It depends on your environment. It depends on your age. It depends on a lot of things.
So then just in the world of addiction, what are the most common addictions? And are there micro addictions?
I don't know that you can really have a micro addiction. So you think about the addiction cycle, you're talking about administration, so exposure to the behavior or to the drug. Then you have to, you're looking at a withdrawal profile. So you feel physically bad when you are in the absence of the drug. So there's definitely like, look, anyone that's tried to cold turkey coffee will know that, you know, you definitely feel withdrawal. Then there's the craving, and then there's eventually tolerance, which means it takes more and more of that behavior or that substance to get the same effect. And actually that effect starts diminishing even as you start increasing your exposure. So in order to follow that specific cycle, I don't think you can really do that on a micro level. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the role of dopamine in our brains is to motivate us to do things. You know, that is dopamine's sole purpose, really, is to keep us alive by telling us when things are good for us. And that means keeping us alive, not necessarily making us happy. So anything that inspires dopamine release in the brain is potentially addictive. So food and sex and video games, because of the novelty, you know, dopamine is also released in novel stimulating environments. So like, you know, Disneyland or video game.
Oh, so I can be addicted to Disneyland?
Yeah.
Potentially?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's a healthy addiction. Are there healthy addictions? Are addictions healthy? I think this is a basic question, but I'm sort of now confused.
When we use the term addiction, we're talking about a chronic but treatable medical condition. Dependence would be a word that someone that studies it at my level, since I'm not a clinician, would call, you know, so I talk about nicotine dependence more than I talk about nicotine addiction, for instance. But, you know, I don't know that we necessarily have healthy addictions by today's societal standards, but evolution certainly thought that making us addicted to sleep and sex and food was a great idea, because that's how we stayed alive and continued the species.
Got it. Okay. So I understand how addiction happens, but how hard is it to break an addiction once one has formed?
I mean, it's really hard. I mean, again, anyone, I will admit I did this experiment for myself. I tried to cold turkey coffee, you know, just like, well, what happened was I was working on a project. I'm sure, yeah, you've had this experience. And it was really challenging project, but it had like a culminating event. And then the next day, because I had been drinking 6 cups of coffee a day, I was like, you know what? For the last month and a half, I'm not sure if I was initiating like thoughts, feelings, and actions, or if the coffee was doing it for me. Let's find out. And so I just stopped drinking coffee for about 5 or 6 months. And it took, I want to say 5 or 6 weeks before like the world had color again. So yes, it's really difficult to break an addiction. I mean, that's why we have an opioid epidemic, and that's why smoking is the world's leading preventable cause of death, is because it's so hard once these cycles start to, it's kind of like being in the roundabout from hell, and like you're in the wrong lane and you can never find the off ramp, you know, being trapped in that cycle. I mean, from nicotine's perspective, you know, 73% of smokers say that they want to stop, but only 5% succeed without some type of assistance. So, you know, this is incredibly difficult.
Can you talk about social media addiction? Is that an actual addiction that we have?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a manipulation of your dopamine system. I mean, I don't know if you'd have to fit it to the model to know if it's like a formal, you know, addiction. But certainly for some people, it definitely is. You know, they will choose social media over other things like the natural high of sex, food, social interaction, taking care of your young, all of that. That's by design, isn't it?
It is. And it's like the same thing with our phones outside of social media. It's just like the notifications, the alerts, like every single buzz we get is a dopamine hit, right? And so one of the things that me and my husband do is like we literally turn off all notifications on every app of our phone. And I use Do Not Disturb quite frequently as a setting on my phone. And I just really try to not let my phone run my brain from a dopamine perspective. And it's really hard. And I think that too many people out there in the world have all their notifications turned on. They've got red dots everywhere. They're buzzing all the time. And it is just like a total shit show in their head. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I think that it will be really interesting to see what I call the Alexa generation, you know, like the babies that have always known a robot that will respond to them if they just shout out at it from the living room, right?
My children are these people.
Yes, yes.
My son literally asks Alexa what the weather is every morning when he wakes up.
Oh, that's so cute.
That's how he gets dressed.
And, you know,
but maybe I'm programming him the wrong way. Is this
no,
bad?
But what is the wrong way, right? Like society evolves, culture evolves. We build this technology. And the whole point of evolution is that the brain adapts. So, yes, the way that brains are being developed to respond to this type of, you know, technological dopamine shower, a shower of dopamine, it's happening. Like, but what will that mean for human interaction, social interaction down the road? I don't know. I also don't think that trying to stop it is that great of an idea.
I am actually excited about new types of social networks and new types of thinking around phones happening. You know, we've got Clubhouse now, which is an audio-only social network. They don't intend to do advertising. It's listening instead of staring at a screen and looking at visual stimulation. And it just feels more human in that way. And then, you know, I'm an investor and one of the companies that I've invested in is still stealth and I can't say much about it, but they're trying to reinvent what comes after the phone. And it's not a thing you hold in your hand. It's not a thing you put in your eyes. It's not contact lenses or Google glasses or any of those things. And it's like a much more humanistic way to use technology to connect with people. To sort of superpower you without the stimulants and the addiction. So I'm excited about where technology can be going. Mm-hmm. And let's switch gears and talk about habits. So how do habits differ from addictions?
So habits are about choices. Addictions are about the lack of choice. And so we can build habits And building habits is not activating the dopamine system per se, but we can kind of use what we know about the dopamine system to improve our habit consistency. But it's about making some pathways in the brain more attractive than others. You know, the term brains are lazy is not accurate, but brains take the easiest path, the most optimized path. And so, you know, if you had a choice between a dirt path in the jungle with the machete or, you know, the carpool lane in a multi-lane freeway, you're probably going to get where you're going faster on the freeway. And so building a habit is really taking the path that you want to be the easiest, fastest, most optimized one, and repeating it consciously over and over again enough times that that is the pathway that becomes the unconscious choice. And then you can kind of go on autopilot. So that's why it takes so long and so much deliberate, conscious effort to be able to build that.
And I've always heard it takes 21 days to make or break a habit. Is that scientific? Is that, there's a book about this called I think The Power of Habits or something like that, that says this.
I never actually looked into the research, so I don't know if there's like a set number of days, but certainly practice and consistency is the most important thing. I would think that there's probably some variation brain to brain.
Well, I was thinking about it because I'm like, is it 21 days or 21 cycles of a habit? Or, you know, if I want to become a runner, do I run every day for 21 days or can I run 21 times?
Run once every 3 weeks. There's the habit.
Right, do I need to run? Yeah, exactly. Make this a habit.
I wish it worked like that.
Exactly. Well, everyone that, you know, probably has dropped off from their New Year's resolutions right now because their habit that they chose has probably not sustained. You know, I think the majority of people can't sustain a new habit, which is why we have fad diets and all of these things.
That's one of my favorite graphs, is like gym attendance between like January and March, like the first quarter of the year, you know, and it's like everybody's going, and then there's like a drastic dip, and then it spikes right before Valentine's Day, and then it goes down.
Oh, really? Yeah, because I read in the data that it's February 8th is the day where it finally like drops off the cliff. So people are good for like 4 to 5 weeks, which, by the way, disputes the whole 21 day theory.
There you go.
So I don't know, but. You know, I think for me, I did this thing a couple of years ago called Give It a Week, where I had all these things I wanted to try or learn. So I just chose a new thing every week and I did it each day for 7 days. And it was kind of like a micro habit, I guess you could say. And I just got to like try new things. I tried diets. I tried learning new creative things. I tried changing my lifestyle, having no social media, for instance, having no phone, for instance, going blonde, like all kinds of things to try it on in my life and at least get a little bit of repetition behind me to understand if it was something I could stick with or if it was going to be a total flop. And the variance was quite large. Like some of them were much easier and others were very difficult. So I can understand that there might be a spectrum of habits, quote unquote, that are easier or harder to stick to. But then again, and then based on your neurotype and your experiences and genetics and all the things, it's probably a big tangled mess. Am I somewhat accurate there?
So when you ran this experiment, this was recently, this was during the pandemic times.
It was before the pandemic.
Before the pandemic. This is an amazing hack for the pandemic times. Like amazing, you know, because the variety and the short-term focus attention on new things is an incredible way to trick your brain into thinking that every day is not the same and that it's not missing out on the world. I think that's, I mean, it's an amazing experiment anyway, but for a pandemic project, that would have been like perfect.
I know. And I did think about repeating it during the pandemic, but because I have kids,
no
childcare and all the things, I was like, I can't throw one more thing on my plate. But to your point, you can ask my husband, you can ask all my best friends, like I was a different person the year I was doing this, like literally, not just because of these projects, but to your point, it was like my mood was different. The days felt different. I was stimulated every day. you know, I think so often we as adults get into these habitual routines of life where it's like, okay, I wake up at this time, I do my breakfast, I go to work, I come home, I, you know, have dinner, put my kids to bed or watch a Netflix show and then repeat. And like how boring that that's the life we live every day for years, right? Like what if there were more? What if you could expose yourself to it, to 100 new things that you never would have thought about? And we keep saying that like one day I'll learn how to play golf, or one day I'll learn how to do photography, or one day I'm going to try to go from dark brunette to blonde. Like, and you never do, like, because you don't have anything that's pressuring you to. So the give it a week challenge, everybody. Crystal's officially endorsing it. You can try it for yourself. It's an amazing thing for your brain.
On the subject of like pandemic and how to build habits, like first off, I want to say that this idea of lazy, it comes with like so much like almost religious moral judgment that I think like needs to stop. Like there's not really such a thing as a lazy brain. There is lack of sufficient incentive. So when you're talking about building habits or changing habits and behaviors, you have to think about like what's your, not your on paper, you know, like your thinking brain, your core, you know, prefrontal cortex motivation to change your behavior, but like your actual evolutionary motivation. Like I'm not going to do things that I don't care about. So like, you know, if you're thinking about changing your habits, like number one is to like reframe the motivation. Like if you are trying not to eat ice cream every night, you know, going to carrot sticks is not going to work. You know, but saying if I, you know, don't eat ice cream and I eat my carrot sticks, then I get one chocolate kiss. So instead of half a pint of Rocky Road,
right,
you get one kiss. And so you still get the dopamine, but you're substituting the behavior, you know, and then the enriched environment, I think, is really, really important. And what you're talking about with your week challenge is really enriching your environment. And I think that during the pandemic, we lost some of that because we weren't getting the novelty, we weren't getting the social interaction, and social inclusion can be so important for self-esteem and can really, I mean, there's a whole side of the brain that we're not talking about that is focused on social inclusion and positive feedback from being in a group. And so if you can activate that, the power of that, which, you know, led to human culture and all of these things, get an accountability buddy. You know, talk to somebody about your experiences. Those are really important ways that you can start to actually make progress on shifting a behavior.
So the pandemic has obviously created a lot of anxiety within us. Is there anything we can do for our brains, for our bodies, to help us move through anxiety more easily?
Yes and no. Anxiety is something that I struggle with. So this question is like really close to my heart. And I will say that like sometimes knowing better doesn't help. Like I can tell you exactly what's going on in my brain, but that doesn't like stop the fact that I am in fact having a panic attack. When we're talking about anxiety and fear, we're talking about, you know, really deep evolutionary mechanisms. We're talking about the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. We're talking about acetylcholine. These are chemicals. Cortisol is another, you know, hormone that's involved in anxiety. These are chemicals that are involved in the fight or flight mechanism. So, you know, something has told your body or your brain that you are in danger of dying. And there's lots of things that can spark that. Social exclusion can spark that. You know, times of extreme uncertainty and change where you just don't feel safe can also spark that. So I think that there's definitely been an uptick of depression and anxiety during the pandemic for many reasons. And I think it's really important to remind ourselves that our brains evolve to keep us alive, but not to make us happy. So, you know, what got us here is not going to get us there. And so when you're experiencing that fight or flight or freeze, sometimes it's freeze, which can be even worse, reaction, understanding that that's the evolutionary mechanism and that there is a way to step up back into your more executive processing place and finding what that is for yourself. You know, for some people it's meditation, for some people it's taking a walk. For me, I really have to take a full sensory approach because emotions are sometimes our way of adding meaning to physical feedback that we're getting. Like the data is physical, right? Like you're ready to fight or flee. And then you have an emotion about it. And that, you know, we call that fear and anxiety. So for me, anything that's physical, so changing the temperature in the room, taking a bath, going for a walk, lighting a scented candle, you know, and doing some deep breathing exercises, changing the lighting, using all five senses, eating a mint sometimes is just
interesting.
Yeah, I used to do that when I was in undergrad. If I was falling asleep in classes, I would have like a bag of sugar or a bag of really, really strong Dutch.
Like Altoids?
Altoids. Oh,
okay.
Like, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Like King peppermints, if anybody knows what those are.
What does that do to you? I've never heard that before.
Well, it shifts your attention, right? Oh. So, you know, if you put something really spicy or, you know, that takes your sensory attention really briefly away, it allows you to refocus back on the lecture. So, ooh, you know, for
I'm going to light some candles and eat some mints. This sounds great. Well, and I love what you were saying about cortisol. I was talking to my therapist recently and I was saying like, I feel, you know, pretty stressed out lately, but I'm also like really chill with it. Like I'm very aware and conscious of it. And she was like, oh, well, that's because you're an island. And I was like, what? And she was like, yeah, you know, you're either an island or a wave or an anchor. And I was like, I've never heard this theory before. And so apparently there are three types of people, the islands, the waves, and the anchors. And the islands are clearly people like me who very solid ground, you know, you could throw anything at me, I will handle it. But apparently she told me, she's like, the thing about islands is that we've actually measured their chemicals in their blood versus the waves and the anchors, and they actually have the most cortisol running through their blood at all times. The thing is, they just like know how to suppress it really well. And the problem is islands don't know how to like extract emotion and like let the cortisol out. And so even though you look like you got it all together, there's a pocket in you that doesn't. And I was like, sweet, thanks. Well, I'm glad I'm actually in therapy so we could talk about this. And then like my husband is like a wave apparently, where it's just like, there's these waves of emotions that just happen all the time. And he's like very emotional and like, but so his like anxiety and stress is just constant, but it's like very obvious and open. And then the anchors, I didn't get the total download on it, but like, I think they like have to go super, super deep to, like they're harder to access. They store it in, I guess, in a different way. But I was just fascinated by this idea that I have more cortisol in my blood than my husband, for instance, when like I feel like I've got like calm and cool and collected Brit over here. And I was like, this is why therapy is amazing. So I love it. Do you agree with any of this? Is this like making sense to you?
I've never heard this model, but I'm not unfamiliar with sort of personality typing, you know, that happens in psychology. But I think it's interesting that perhaps like the increased rise in cortisol is really like that buffering for you, like so that you can push through, and the stress relief that your husband feels from being able to express and move through that more quickly is probably allowing cortisol to kind of happen in a more wave-like pattern. It makes sense. I can't say if it's, you know, like the research backs it up, but
I don't need you to scientifically validate it with a stamp. I'm just, for anyone listening who might be an island or a wave, now you can actually feel justified in yourself. So what is happening though to our brains when we're stressed out or we're sleep deprived? Like what, is there a chemical imbalance there?
Well, I think stress and sleep are connected, but not the same. So I have a good friend of mine, Allie Ward, who hosts the Ologies podcast, and we talk about stress and anxiety. She calls her amygdala, which is the tiny region that's sort of responsible for managing the emotions around stress and fear. She calls it her screaming almond of death. Because she experiences, you know, all of this anxiety, and it's like this area is like really hyper, and I totally get that. So for stress, it's really like activation of those like emergency systems, those survival systems. It's meant to be a short-term thing. I will say that biologically and neuroscience, you can have good and bad stress. So, you know, sometimes you need good stressors in order to push through, you know, to grow, to create new neural connections. So that can happen. But right now, you know, in colloquial like terms, stress always means something negative. Now, sleep is huge. Sleep is when your brain cleans house. Without sleep, you will end up, it's like never cleaning your house. Eventually, it looks like a hoarder, and, you know, function is absolutely diminished, if not impossible. So you need good sleep. You need consistent sleep. Studies have shown that your mom was right. You can't actually catch up on sleep. So sleeping a smaller number of hours, but the same number of hours consistently is better than, you know, 2 days a week getting 14 hours of sleep and the rest getting 3. And it's what you're doing when you're sleeping is you're synthesizing, you're adding meaning to things that happened. You are creating new memories. You are clearing out your hard drive so that it makes space for the things that really matter. You know, if you could do one thing for brain health, it would be sleep, and sleep consistently, and sleep deeply.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of sleep, and I track my sleep. I track my deep sleep, my REM sleep. I've got the Oura Ring. I've got the sleep mattress pad. I'm like all about sleep track. We actually have a podcast about sleep. If anyone wants to go back and listen to it, it's called Better Sleep is the name of the episode. So go back and look for that. I guess lastly on mood, like what are some tips for boosting mood other than get good sleep that we might not have thought about from a scientific perspective?
I think that one of the things that we look in answering this question, I feel bad because I really want to add something that's like revolutionary and super high tech. At like this esoteric idea about this is the way that you should think about mood. But like, eat fresh, nutrient-dense foods. Sleep consistently. Drink water. Go for a walk.
Go outside, you know, in the sun.
Expose yourself to sunlight. I'm not saying go and get a tan, but what I'm saying is let yourself appreciate when the sun is up and when the sun is going down. Like pay attention to those transitions to reinforce your circadian rhythm so that you can get better sleep. I'm saying this at almost 3 a.m. in Jakarta, so I am not following my own advice, but this is, you know, these are the things that you really can do. And if those things are not working, and if the habit and behavioral change approaches that we've discussed are not working, go and see somebody that can help.
Yes, just do it. Totally, 100%. This has been so fun. What are some of your favorite brain stats that we might have missed during our chat? Is there anything like really fascinating that you've come across in all of your time studying the brain?
Well, two things come to mind. One is that, you know, most of the research that I did was in cells that were grown on a dish. But the cool thing about the cells in those dishes is that they were expressing fluorescent proteins. So my studying of that one subunit of that one receptor, et cetera, was really like following it around by shooting it with lasers and then taking pictures of like where the fluorescence did. So I tell high school students that like I'm a neuroscientist, but I really make brains glow in the dark.
Pretty cool.
which is pretty cool. But since then, techniques have evolved. And there's a Caltech professor, Viviana Gradinaro, who actually will take entire intact brains, clear the cholesterol and the sugars and everything out of them. So you have only the fibrous materials, and it looks like a clear jelly, like a clear gummy bear, basically. So it's completely clear. And then those brains, mouse brains, of course, not human brains, are expressing fluorescent proteins. And you can shoot those brains with lasers, and you can see whole structures of like selectively labeled fluorescent in a whole organ. And you know, for years, we've been learning about the brain by cutting brains open and slicing them up and taking a look. So to be able to study a whole intact organ non-invasively, completely through making your brain clear and then shooting it with lasers and watching it glow in the dark is probably one of my favorite techniques out there.
This is amazing. I actually hadn't heard of this, but I know that we know so little about the brain, and it's incredible. Like, I've been studying creativity as part of Brit & Co. for 10 years. We literally don't know where in the brain creativity comes from. The whole right brain, left brain thing is sort of obscure. Like, and I was fascinated by how little we know about the most powerful organ in our body outside of our heart. So this is really, really cool. And hopefully this creates a lot of opportunity to learn more about what triggers what, and how we can start connecting the dots between these 100 billion neurons.
It's highly complex, right? Yeah. And if you just want to look at some really pretty brain pictures, type rainbow into your Google image search.
Rainbow. I love this.
Rainbow. Okay. And you'll see all of these different fluorescent neurons, all labeled different colors. And it'll like introduce you to this technicolored world of fluorescent proteins in brains. And, you know, that's the world that I live in.
I love it. I love it. Crystal Dilworth, thank you so much for being here with us. What is the one piece of homework you would give to our listeners this week? It could be mood or habit or addiction related.
Ooh, try sleeping with your phone in another room.
Ooh, give it a week, you guys. Try sleeping with your phone in another room. I've never done that. I'm just going to say that. So I will do this. I'll report back.
Okay,
Crystal, yes. Thank you so much for being here with us. And where can we find you?
I am at Polycrystal HD on most social media platforms, and on CBS Saturday mornings on the show Mission Unstoppable as Dr. Brain.
Love it. Love it. Thanks so much, Crystal.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Teach Me Something New, a production of iHeartRadio and Brit & Co. I'm your host, Brit Morin. Find more information about each episode at brit.co/listen. You can also find me on social media. I'm at Brit, or follow us at Brit & Co. Teach Me Something New is executive produced by Ali Ives and Ali Perry, with additional production and sound design by Mark Lemmerjazy and Aaron Peterson.